Empire podcast this week, we step up to the trench with Ben Wheatley, director of Meg 2, The Streets. Or maybe the other way round. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is cutting back on stupid jokes. Some of you will be relieved to hear. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to a stupid joke-free zone that is this week's Empire podcast. We are recording this remotely due to laziness. Is that a stupid joke? I don't know. It's
accurate,
a minefield.
I would say.
It's a minefield. No, but why are we recording this remotely? My two colleagues of such lethal cunning, Ben Travis.
Hello.
And James Dyer. Why are we remote? Remind me.
Well, a number of reasons, I would say. Partly the office is closed.
But we don't record in the office.
We don't record in the office. We do record in the studio. We're lazy and we didn't want to go into town. And I'm trying to write a feature. So I didn't want to go all the way into town to do it and come back.
Yes.
That's the reason why.
Jimbo and Ben are here. Helen is in Northern Ireland, frolicking through fields and, you know, the 40 shades of green and all that sort of stuff. It's a wonderful time.
She was at the Giant's Causeway the other day.
Are you stalking Helen on social media?
By stalking, like, I follow Helen on Instagram. Why wouldn't I? That's an extremely normal thing to do.
Wow.
I just asked her to say hello to Hellboy for me at the Giant's Causeway, which is the true, you know, traditional greeting when you visit that part of the world. Say hello to Hellboy.
And say hello to Finn McCool while you're there as well, the giant who built the Giant's Causeway and who, legend has it, is also responsible for creating the Isle of Man. That's one legend anyway, that he was... Finn McCool's height changes wildly from story to story. In some stories, he's just like a 25-foot giant who built this Giant's Causeway, and the story is that he built this Giant's Causeway because he had beef with another giant in Scotland. And so he built the Giant's Causeway to meet the giant to kick seven shades of shit out of him. And then when he started seeing how big the other Scottish giant was, he turned tail and ran. Finn, not so cool. So in one story, he's like 25 feet or so. But in another story, he was so enraged one day that he put his mighty fist into the earth and scooped out this massive chunk of land and flung it into the sea. And that became the Isle of Man, and water rushed in to the hole left by his excavation, and that became Loch Ness. Now, for that to work, Finn McCool in that telling would have to be several hundred feet tall at least, so it's a bit variable. Basically, what I'm saying is, sort your fucking shit out, early tellers of stories.
Maybe he's like Ant-Man.
Maybe he is.
He can just change his height at will.
Maybe Finn McCool was the first person to access a quantum realm.
Yeah, Pym particles, that's your answer.
I'm fully on board now. 5 stars to Finn McCool.
Pym McCool.
I'm not just asking Pym this McCool. Because I have my Max Rebo Band t-shirt on, but is Finn McCool by any chance related to Droopy McCool of the Max Rebo Band? Of the McCool dynasty?
No, but Slice Noodles is a very well-known character from Northern Irish mythology. Do any of you know the names of that little furball that turned up in the special editions?
No.
I wish I did.
Neither do I. I should do, but no, I don't.
Ben, you know, do we all know the names of the Max Rebo Band? We all know all the players. So Droopy McCool, Max Rebo,
yeah.
And...
Slice Noodles.
But who's it? There's another guy, isn't there? There's another guy?
Is there?
I thought they were a trio.
Max is on keyboards. Droopy's on what looks like an oboe. I think that's pretty much it. They don't have a drummer.
Slice Noodles is on Pure Vibes.
Yes, Slice Noodles is the vibes man. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Dave Grohl's done a few sets with him.
He may well have done.
At some point, the law of averages will suggest that Dave Grohl will turn up and do a set.
Here's my little Max Rebo plush from this year's Star Wars Celebration. So at Celebration in the shop, they had the whole band as a set of plushes. I just have Max Rebo, but the band set they had was Max Rebo, Droopy McCool, and Slice Noodles. There wasn't a fourth member unless there's been some kind of, I don't know, Fleetwood Mac style.
I'm misremembering.
Beef, some kind of, you know, this one was in a relationship with that one and then they broke up and they're out of the band and now they're all doing cocaine. And if Disney Plus is listening, I would watch that as a show.
But wouldn't you love to see a sort of behind the music style documentary about the Max Rebo Band, The Breakups?
No, to be clear, so first of all, I've just gone on Wikipedia.
Uh-huh.
It was a 12-member band. I don't know where the rest of the band was at Jabba's Palace, but apparently after they were so traumatized by the destruction of the sail barge and the death of Jabba at the Great Pit of Carcoon, the band broke up.
What?
After that, they escaped the sail barge. They did not die with Jabba, but the band broke up.
Well, it would be traumatic because it was a big explosion and there was jizz everywhere. You'd want to hang up your saxophone, your space saxophone at that point, wouldn't you?
Well, I know you guys try and forget the Book of Boba Fett at most opportunities, but do you remember Max Rebo was in that? He was in Jennifer Beals, was that her name? She owned a casino or a fancy club, and Max Rebo was, you know, doing his jizz thing in the club. Well, essentially,
he's gone. Yeah, but that's because he went solo. He's gone full Harry Styles. Like, he's broken off on his own. He's now a solo act. The band has fallen apart. Here's a fact. So I've gone down the Wikipedia fucking Rancor hole now.
Sarlacc hole.
Do you know that the Rancor had a name, and its name was Patissa?
Oh,
Jabba's pet Rancor was called Patissa. Can either of you name the band in the cantina on Mos Eisley?
Yes, Figurin Dan and the Modal Nodes.
That's correct. That is correct. I bet you couldn't pick Figurin Dan out of a fucking lineup, though.
We need to have a battle of the bands.
We do.
This would be amazing. Also, I think that Glastonbury 1 year, Max Rebo would absolutely kill it in the legend slot.
Yes.
Imagine if that happened. Imagine if Max Rebo turned up on stage 5 o'clock Sunday and just smacked the living shit out of it. That'd be amazing.
Well, as we discussed on the live Return of the Jedi podcast we did from Star Wars Celebration, Max Rebo has insane range. He could do his own Eras tour because every single song he plays in Return of the Jedi is vastly different from the other songs. Sometimes he's in like pure funk mode, sometimes he's in experimental jazz. I'm pretty sure he had a big pop phase at some point. Incredible range from Max Rebo.
That'd be great. Turn up the Glastonbury, have a bite out of a freshly baked Ewok, and there you go. Off you go. Max Rebo. Amazing stuff. Listen, should we have a question?
Yes.
Let's do it.
All right. So I'm springing this on you guys, but I think this is a really good question. This comes from Asfar Shah, and he asks, are there any franchises with at least one star, one 2-star, three star, one 4-star and one 5-star entry?
No.
Well, good to see you gave the interrogation. I mean,
but no.
The focus that question deserved.
Because how many franchises have a 5-star entry? And I would argue that none that have a 5-star entry have a 1-star entry. However, there is definitely an argument. Obviously, Ben's got his hand up. I know what you're going to say. You're absolutely right. Rise of Skywalker probably is a 1-star film.
No.
So you probably do have, broadly speaking, the spread in Star Wars. So yes, okay, fair enough. That's the answer. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for the help.
Trapped in fucking Groundhog Day every time you guys mention Rise of Skywalker.
I'm not rising to it. I'm happy. Rise of Skywalker, good movie.
Rise.
A couple of things immediately spring to mind. The first one that sprang to mind was, there is no 5-star yet, but I would say the current iteration of the MonsterVerse, the Godzilla Warner Brothers MonsterVerse. So famously, Godzilla King of the Monsters, 1-star. 1-star shite. Terrible.
Although, this is just you. To be fair, this is the Ben scale. Because you took violently against that film, but you are slightly on a ledge with that one.
It's deeply bad. It's deeply bad. It made me so cross. I'm struggling now because I think there maybe actually isn't a 2-star one, because Godzilla is 3 stars, as is Kong Skull Island, and Godzilla versus Kong is 4. So there's not a 2. Okay, scratch that. But the one, as James was talking, going, what is it? Why is there a 5-star and a 1-star? Batman. I know it's not all the same continuity, but there is absolutely a 1-star Batman film, a 2-star Batman film, a 3-star Batman film, a 4-star Batman film, and several 5-star Batman films.
There is. There is.
Cheating, but okay.
It's not cheating. You see, James, you what you did was you dismissed something out of hand immediately without giving it the proper time.
Surely not.
and commitment. And Ben, yeah, that's a really good one. So, okay. So what's your 5-star Batman entry, Ben?
Oh, I mean, Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, probably the two. So what was your Rancor noise for?
Batman Begins is not a 5-star
Ooh.
Film. You get full Rancor noise for that.
Batman Begins is amazing.
Yeah, okay, 4 stars?
4 stars, Dark Knight Rises, The Batman, the Tim Burton, both the Tim Burtons, probably a 4 for me. Then the three...
Another Rancor noise.
All right, or, okay, or 3 stars.
Actually, maybe the Batman is 3 for me. I kind of keep forgetting that film exists. When we were doing our lists last year, it would get to the end of year and I was looking back on what did I see, and I just straight up forget that the Batman happened. It has great stuff in it, but it's probably a 3 for me. 2 is going to be your Batman Forever, and 1 is going to be Batman and Robin.
Yeah, Batman and Robin, one of the worst films ever made. Yeah, I think that's a solid answer. Obviously, this has to apply to franchises that have more than 5 entries, unless your franchise is wildly variable, like Mac Rebo's career, and you have 5 films in your franchise, and one of them is a 5, and one of them is a 1, and 2 and a 3 and a 4. Well done to you, if so. Jimbo, have you thought about this a little bit more?
Maybe a touch. If we're gonna spread things out a bit, you can probably make an argument for the Alien franchise, right?
If we extend it to the Predator movies, then yes.
Yeah, like I think we can. Well, because so Alien and Aliens, both 5-star films, right?
Yes, undeniable. Yes. What's the 4-star? What's the 4-star in that franchise?
The 4-star is the one that I'm slightly stuck on at the moment. That's the one I'm struggling with, because like Alien 3, I'd give a 3 to. Same with Alien Resurrection. I think weirdly, I think we could go 2 for Alien versus Predator, and if we really stretch it, 1 for Alien versus Predator Requiem.
I don't think we're stretching at all. I think Aliens versus Predator Requiem is an abomination of a movie.
I mean, it's terrible. It's terrible. Yeah. It's the 4 that I'm struggling with. But so I think in that case, we might need to sort of lean into the Predator-ness of it. But I think a pure Predator film feels a little bit wrong.
No.
So then, but then for a 4, do we go with... I mean, look, okay. For a 4, pick like a Covenant or a Prometheus.
I was going to say Prometheus, and then I didn't know if I was going to get yelled at on the internet and by you two in person right now. But yeah, Prometheus has some issues, but there's so much great stuff in there. Covenant, I kind of have a weird soft spot for, although I think that's a really good Prometheus sequel and a not great Alien movie. Yeah. So if we're talking Alien movies, it's probably a 3 or 2-star Alien movie versus a 4-star Prometheus sequel. I don't know how that works.
But then weirdly, I would say Covenant is more of an Alien film. Prometheus for me almost isn't an Alien film. It is in the continuity, but it kind of isn't an Alien film. But I really like it as a kind of this wild and wacky, ambitious sci-fi film. I know it got a lot of shit because it wasn't what people wanted it to be, but I actually do enjoy it. Whereas Covenant, I think weirdly, it has good moments. I do like it. It's somewhere between a 3 and a 4. I'd have to watch it again to be sure. But I think we've got the whole spread here, especially if we can give Requiem the kicking it deserves. I think we can do 1 to 5 here.
I don't think there's a 4. I don't think there is. I know a lot of people go to bat for Prometheus. I just don't see it. I mean, Alien 3, you could maybe make that argument.
The assembly cut of 3, I reckon, is a 4. I genuinely do. The theatrical cut is 100% a 3. If we can include the assembly cut, I would definitely give that a 4, because it makes the film so much better.
Okay.
Fincher wouldn't agree, but I maintain it is.
He really would not. He would not. I think this is a really great question, by the way. And there are so many franchises that I think do kind of qualify. Let's talk horror, shall we? Let's talk horror.
Yes.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Is the first one a 5?
Absolutely. First one's a 5. Yeah.
It's definitely a high 4. It might be a 5.
It's not might be a 5. It's a 5.
Okay.
The first one is a 5. Freddy's Dead is a 1.
Agreed.
Dream Warriors is a 4. And for me, it's a 5. But for most, I think it would be a 4.
I love Dream Warriors.
And then you have a smattering of 2s and a smattering of 3s.
Yeah.
In there.
Halloween, I think, absolutely fits into that as well. Like, the original Carpenter nailed on 5 stars, nailed to the wall with a giant butcher's knife through the chest. 4-star ones, maybe Halloween 2. I actually really like the first David Gordon Green Halloween film. That's kind of a 4 for me. There are definitely some ones in there. Most of the Thorn trilogy, the weird middle trilogy of Halloween, when it gets into some weird like cult shit.
Halloween Resurrection.
Halloween Resurrection also a flat out 1. H2O is easily a 4.
H2O
is a 4.
H2O is a 4. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Is a 3 for me. That's going to be my 3.
For me, that's a 5.
But I know we're vastly different on that.
You're an idiot and a fool. And I think you should wear the silver shamrock mask and watch the magic pumpkin.
That's a deeply bad thing. That's going to kill me, Chris. There's going to be snakes coming out of my face.
Is it, Ben? Is it? Oh, I forgot about that. Oh, well. What a shame. Oh, well. let's talk about some of the ones that have loads and loads of entries, right?
Okay. So can I make an argument for Star Trek?
Go on, then.
I can't believe I dismissed this out of hand. You're right, there are tons of examples of this. I'm a lunatic. But like, okay, Star Trek. So one star film, Star Trek V. I'm throwing that in there. That's going straight under the bus.
That's fair.
There are, Star Trek the Motion Picture, I would argue, is a two. You could possibly scrape a three if you were feeling charitable.
See,
but
some
not
people
a huge
think
fan.
That's a five.
They do, and they're wrong because it's terrible. but other two. Some people would say Insurrection is a two. That's a four for me because I love it. But the two, I think, is a trickier area. There are so many threes in there, it's not even funny. Fours, I mean, take your pick. I think a lot of the next gen ones could go into four. Nemesis, people don't like. I think it's great. I'd give that four. I think we gave it three. Five wise, Wrath of Khan is a five. First Contact's probably a four, if I'm honest with you, even though it's my favorite of the lot on a personal level. Of the JJ ones, Into Darkness, again, for me, I like it, but that's three, I think, for most people. Original, like the 2009 Star Trek, is probably a four, isn't it? I would say.
I'd say that's a five.
You say? I really love it, but I don't think many people would call it an all-time classic. I think it's brilliant. And then Star Trek Beyond, I'd give four as well. I think that's great. I really, really enjoyed that one too. So I think we've got a decent spread there.
Yeah, I think weirdly enough, Star Trek Beyond has been revised. There's been a lot of revisionism about that, and people now seem to dismiss it as a bad one. But I think it's really good.
No, it's great. It's got a lot of fun. There's a clear affection for the franchise in there. I think Peg did a brilliant job.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. It's the two stars. It's where you land on the two star camp. Like Search for Spock again. It's probably a three.
No. That's a four.
Four? I wouldn't give it four. I'd give it three. I don't love it. It's definitely not a two.
Motion picture is a two. Generations is a two.
Generations is not a two. What are you talking about? It's definitely at least a three.
It's not at least a three.
Stop it. The Undiscovered Country is a high four. That's a fucking great film.
What's number nine? The Insurrection.
Nine. No. So you've got, it's Insurrection. Yeah, Insurrection is nine. Yeah. First Contact is eight.
Nine's not
Nemesis
good.
Is 10. Again, Nemesis is really good. People don't give it the credit it's due. It's like Nemesis has a lot going for it.
No.
You're not having it.
Not having Nemesis.
Yeah.
All right. I don't think the MCU qualifies. Genuinely don't.
Nothing below a two.
I don't think there's a one star in the MCU. Secret Invasion
doesn't count.
Secret Invasion doesn't count.
It's a one disguised as a three.
Four stars, Empire Magazine.
Four stars, based on the first two episodes.
True, very true. No, MCU doesn't dip enough. It does not dip enough. It's got twos, it's got threes, it's got fours, it's got fives. It doesn't have any ones.
I think the DCEU does qualify for this.
Is there a five in
I
the
think
DCEU?
There's absolutely Wonder Woman for me is a five.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
No, see, Wonder Woman is lauded for being fabulous, but it is fabulous relative to the others. I think standing on its own, I think the third act has enough problems that it doesn't achieve classic status. I really enjoy it. It's got brilliant moments in it, but I do not think that is close to a five-star film.
It's got David Thewlis pretending to be a foreign lady.
He's the God of War.
You're Wonder Woman, you're a bit of a cheeky monkey. and he's throwing stuff at her.
Terrible experiment.
Hear me out, guys. Wonder Woman 1984 is standing right there.
Oh, fuck off. Absolutely.
It's not
fuck
a five
off.
Stars,
but it's good. It's a fucking two star film.
No, absolutely not Wonder Woman 1984. Although that does lead to the question of what the one star film in the DCEU is. I think I know what it is. In fact, I know what it is.
Is there a one star?
There absolutely is. And it's David Ayer's Suicide Squad.
Is it a one, though? I mean,
it's
a one. Empire Magazine gave this four stars. So,
yes.
Do you know what? Suicide Squad is a bad film. I don't think it's one. I'm looking at the list now. I genuinely, hand on heart, without my trolling Ben hat on, think Wonder Woman 1984 is the weakest of the entire run of DCEU movies.
You think
it's worse
than David Ayer's Suicide Squad?
I genuinely do.
Bonkers.
My hatred for that film could solve the world's energy crisis. Honestly, I can't stand it. I cannot stand it.
Sure, things are bad, but they could be better.
Oh my God, kill me now.
James's one wish is that Wonder Woman 1984 doesn't exist.
Yes, true. No, but it's Suicide Squad. That film is wretched.
It's not good.
But there are many, many other franchises. Many, many other
wonderful franchises. Or the Police Academy is not one of them because it doesn't have a five-star film. Although the first one is a four.
Is it that way?
Yes, the Police Academy one is brilliant. What are you talking about?
Brilliant, just doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
Oh, listen, come on.
I love it. I think it is still the movie that I've seen most in my life. But no. No, come on, let's be realistic here. Bond, let's talk Bond, shall we?
Let's talk Bond. Let's talk
25 Bond films. Let's not count the original Casino Royale or Never Say Never Again. 25 Bond films. Is there a five? Yes.
Goldfinger. Possibly. Goldfinger. Possibly Casino Royale.
Yeah, I'd vouch for that. I'd vouch for the Daniel Craig Casino Royale. Maybe Skyfall. Oh, actually, I've kind of always been a bit of a four on Skyfall. I've thought sometimes
Skyfall
thought
feels to me
stars.
A four. It's a very good, solid four.
Yeah,
but it feels like a four.
But the Casino Royale, Daniel Craig, that for me is as good as Bond gets. As is Goldfinger. Goldfinger is excellent.
I think there are a couple more fives knocking around in the Bond pantheon. I think that you could make an argument. If someone would make an argument, I'm not a fan of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, but you could make an argument that every Bond has a five-star film.
Could you?
You could. You could absolutely make that argument.
It would be a winning argument.
It would be a winning argument, and allow me to make it. Connery has Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice. Lazenby only has one film. But some people think it might even be the best film. I'm not a fan.
It's good. It's not bad. It's not a bad Bond. It's just not a five-star Bond.
But Steven Soderbergh might argue otherwise, and I would like to see that happen on this podcast. Then we come to Moore, and I think The Spy Who Loved Me is absolutely a five-star film. Yeah, five.
Four.
No, I think five. This is not the Scottish football results. Four, far, five. He's 5-4. Then we come to T. Daltz, the best of them all, the greatest Bond of all, and the greatest Bond film of them all.
Don't do it.
License to Kill, motherfuckers. Five
was that
stars
the official title?
All the way. It was.
Yes. License to Kill, motherfuckers.
It was originally called License Revoked, motherfuckers. In fact, we had a question this week about title changes in the wake of something. I can't remember what. But License Revoked, I always think is a better title than License to Kill, I must say. Anyway, then we come into the Bronholm era, and I think Bronholm smacked it straight out of the gate with GoldenEye. You can make a five-star argument for GoldenEye. One-star argument for James's rendition of Tina Turner's GoldenEye. Then you have the Daniel Craig era, and you could make a two five-star argument for him with Skyfall and Casino Royale for sure. But here's the other side of that coin. There's a flip side to that coin. Is there a one-star Bond film? Yes.
Yes, absolutely is. Go on, what do you think is the nadir of Bond?
It's a toss-up between Die Another Day Octopussy.
I saw Octopussy in the cinema and loved it as a kid, but it hasn't aged as well as, yeah. I don't think either of them are ones, I'll be honest.
I think Die Another
Day is
a one.
I don't think they're ones. I think they're comfortably two stars.
All right, okay.
I don't think this qualifies. I don't think Bond has ever gone to the lowest of the low.
All right. Two more big franchises, and then I want to do a very specific, very, very quick take on this. Harry Potter and the Wizarding World of Harry Potter.
There are no fives in that series.
And there's no ones. I love them all, but I don't think there's a five. I don't think there's a one either, though. Crimes of Grindelwald is a two, if we're counting Fantastic Beasts stuff. I think Secrets of Dumbledore was a three.
I would say everything directed by David Yates is a two.
That is so objectively wrong. That is incredibly wrong. His run of Potter, he directed the best one, which is Order of the Phoenix, and that's the hill that
he
I die on.
He didn't direct the best one because the best one is A Prisoner of Azkaban.
I know, and everyone says that. Everyone says that, and
I have to say, I'm maybe. Much as it wounds me to say this in Ben's camp here, Order of the Phoenix is the worst book and the best film.
Anywho, last one, Star Wars. Have at it.
They're all five stars.
It's what I was going to say about the MCU. How could you possibly do this for the MCU? Because it's 31 five-star films. Is there a one?
There is a one.
Even as bad as The Rise of Skywalker, objectively is, Ben.
Let's not relitigate this.
Rise of Skywalker is a three. Even though I hate it, it's a three.
What about the prequels?
The prequels, there's no one star in the prequels.
Surely Attack of the Clones is the five we're all looking for, right?
Nailed on.
Nailed on.
Nailed on 5 stars.
If we had to make a case for Star Wars, the thing I would maybe put for the 1 star, and it feels very harsh, but recently I tried rewatching the Clone Wars movie, because I was like, maybe I will finally watch the Clone Wars. I've watched all of Rebels now. I'm an episode away from finishing Resistance, so maybe I should get around to finally watching Clone Wars, and I should start by rewatching the Clone Wars animated movie, which I did see in the cinema back in the day and remembered very little about. Much as it pains me to even indicate that Dave Filoni could be involved in something that is 1 star, I got halfway through the Clone Wars movie, The Clone Wars, and you spent half an hour titting around with Stinky, who is Jabba the Hutt's
the baby Hutt son.
I have not finished. I started watching that like a month and a half ago. I have not finished it. I couldn't get through. I couldn't get past Stinky. So if we really had to make a case for a 1 star, I think that might be it. Are we including Holiday Special? Does Holiday Special count?
No. Holiday Special might be a 1 star, actually. I mean, that's fair. Although it's a curio, isn't it? It's a cultural artifact, so maybe it's beloved in that regard. I'm surprised that actually that you've taken so badly against the Clone Wars movie. Like, it's not good. I reviewed this when it first came out for Empire, and I gave it 3, which I kind of stand by, to be honest. I think it does some okay stuff.
But this is Ben's MO. Like, your murderers come with smiles. Like,
he's all in or all out.
He's all wreathed in friendliness and flowers and hugs until he sees something perfectly fine, like Godzilla King of the Monsters. And then out come the knives, schnicktigular claws.
Yeah.
So I googled films with 5 entries in the series because I want to see if there is a franchise that runs the gamut. From 5 to 1. And there are a couple of contenders. There are more franchises that have 5 films exactly than you might think. Bourne is one of them, right? I'm not saying for a second that qualifies.
5 fours,
but Bourne
3
is one.
Maybe 2 threes. Don't think it's even got 2.
It's got 2. I would say
Bourne Legacy is probably 3, isn't it?
I'd say that's 2. Bourne
it's
Legacy.
Right. It's not that bad.
Die Hard. Now, James and I were discussing this off mic.
Yeah.
I think there's an argument to be made for Die Hard ticking all the boxes.
I know what you're saying, but A Good Day to Die Hard, while lamentable,
I think it's 1.
Is 2.
I think it's 1. You could, if you were molding your argument specifically to fit this category and saying something in which you didn't entirely believe. You could go Die Hard is 5, Die Hard with a Vengeance, which is actually 5, is 4, Die Hard 2, which is actually 4, is 3, and then Live Free or Die Hard, or Die Hard 4.0 is 2, that's incontrovertible, and then you have A Good Day to Die Hard, which is fucking shite, and until recently was the worst action franchise to have a scene set in Chernobyl, is absolutely a 1 star thing.
I mean, it's bad, but I think it's 2. I think 1 feels punitive, but actually it is hateful. So I don't know. I do remember being consumed with an almost homicidal fury when I came out of that film. So
that sounds like 1 to me, James. Homicidal fury is definitely Godzilla King of the Monsters 1 star mode.
I think it might be Die Hard. I think Die Hard might be the ultimate answer to this question, in that it's a 5-film franchise that has a 5, a 4, a 3, a 2, and a 1. All right. Nailed it. Nailed it. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast, then Twitter, and yes, I am still calling it Twitter, as all right-thinking people must.
Musk.
Musk. Then get in touch with me on that. I'm at Chris Hewitt. You can slide into my DMs as long as you haven't used up your allotment. Or you can reply to any of my panicked shout-outs or reply to any of my tweets once you've stopped laughing, of course. Oh, Phantasm.
Is that your new catchphrase just every so often? Oh, Phantasm.
Oh, Phantasm.
I faked every Phantasm. All right. Let's move straight into movie news. And there was some Wonder Woman-related news, wasn't there, Jimbo?
There was indeed, that Gal Gadot has threatened a third film in this franchise.
Come on now.
Until her demands are met.
Yes, we must send her $1 million or there will be a Wonder Woman 3. Wonder Woman 1985 will be thrust upon us. There may be. I'm confused by this because obviously the DCEU's reboot seems to be a little bit like the SAG-AFTRA kind of special exemptions thing. It's completely rebooted except when it isn't, under these very specific conditions. So we may see more Wonder Woman. Hopefully it will be not, you know, 80 set Wonder Woman, but we'll see.
As Helen has pointed out many times, and in fact, as she's written about in her book, Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film, available now in all good and evil bookstores. You know, Patty Jenkins was a movie jail after Monster, a film that won its lead an Oscar. Couldn't get a movie made for 14 years, made Wonder Woman. Great film. I think it's 5 stars. I think it's the best film in the DCEU. I think it's tremendous. A real throwback to Richard Donner Superman. Turned Gal Gadot into worldwide star. They made a second film a few years later. It was a bit of a stinker in most people's opinions. I know Ben.
Most
you
know, right thinking people.
Differs. Come on, come on, come on. Let's not relitigate the relitigation. And then since then, she hasn't. She's effectively in movie jail again. This is so weird. I mean, it shows the double standards and the hypocrisy in Hollywood. And it's you know, I think that honestly that they should have been given another go, you know, to make a third movie together. And in terms of the continuity of the DCEU, Blue Beetle is out in 2 weeks' time, and they're talking about that kind of possibly being something that ports over. I would be surprised if that movie makes enough of a dent for them to in the box office for them to for them to feel the need to port it over to the new DCU, as it's going to be called.
I think there's definitely an argument for making amends, because I think, like, as regardless of whether it's 5 or 4, Wonder Woman is a great film, and it's, you know, it's at the very top end of the DCEU stuff. And then Wonder Woman 1984, I think, sometimes sort of tars the original Wonder Woman. It detracts from it slightly. I think if they could go out on a high, that would certainly be the preferred option. So
just seems like a weird choice. Like, Wonder Woman was such a cornerstone of all of that, and it's the element of, well, I guess Aquaman's kind of carrying on because Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom is still coming up, and it seems like Ezra Miller might still be the Flash to an extent in the DCU, and I don't know, Viola Davis is crossing over as Amanda Waller. There's still quite a lot of a weird amount of connective tissue between the two. It's not the clean break that we were maybe sold it as being, which then makes it even weirder if Gal Gadot is not continuing as Wonder Woman, because she's great. And I genuinely, like, all jokes aside, I do prefer the second one to the first one. I there's so much about that second one that I like. I don't know
that I can share podcast air with you from this point on.
This is why we're recording remotely, people. But it would feel weird for her not to do it. It was strange when it was like, oh no, that project is going to be cancelled, whereas other things are kind of continuing on. The interesting thing here is that this is Gal Gadot speaking to, I think, comicbook.com and saying, oh yeah, I think I'm going to be, from what I've heard, I'm going to be developing a Wonder Woman 3 with James Gunn and Peter Safran. So very much in the DCU continuity, but there's no mention of Patty in there. It does not necessarily sound like Patty Jenkins would be involved in that. And she was not just the director on the first two, but she was kind of a real key creative voice in kind of pulling those films together and what those films were going to be, rather than a director who just kind of hopped on to a bunch of existing stuff and made it, you know? I hope for good things for Patty Jenkins. I was sad that Rogue Squadron, her Star Wars movie, didn't go ahead. And then it was kind of because she's got Wonder Woman 3 happening, and then that's not happening. It seems like she's potentially in a similar place almost to like Henry Cavill, of just being caught between the gears of things and has kind of fallen through cracks in a way that doesn't seem particularly fair. So, hope for good things for Patty Jenkins. Would be happy for more Gal Gadot Wonder Woman. I mean, she's popped up in enough cameos this year in DCEU movies to boot. So, like, if that was the end of her time as Wonder Woman, it feels like a whimper to end on.
We'll always have Wonder Woman. We'll always have Hans Zimmer's little theme. That bit. I love that bit. It's weird. Anyway, who knows? And who knows what will happen? Who knows when people will actually be able to make movies of this scale again? There has been a little bit of movement in terms of the writer's strike. Now, as you're listening to this from Friday the 4th of August, today, Friday the 4th of August, I believe, is when the AMTP have actually reached out to the Writers Guild of America and will be sitting down for talks with them. Now, if I were the Writers Guild, I would remember the example of Joe Pesci in Goodfellas and be a little bit wary. if you walk into an empty room, and just watch out, folks. Or it might be full Joss Ackland and Lethal Weapon 2, or Derek O'Connor. I was just checking to see if I was standing on plastic. So just be careful. Be careful, guys. But hopefully that this is the beginning of a rapprochement. Hopefully this is the beginning of the umptipoop realizing that they actually do need to meet the writers more than halfway and meet the actors more than halfway as well, because it's kind of crazy, how long this has gone on and how long it could go on. So hopefully this is the beginning of a thawing.
Let us hope. Let us hope and pray.
We shall see. We shall see. Fingers crossed. What else has been happening? There has been a lot of casting news for obvious reasons, but there was a director announcement last night, which is very interesting. And this has pleased Ben and myself in particular, because it seems that Scream 7 is moving ahead. And it seems that Radio Silence, so Tyler Gillette and Matt Bettinelli Ulpin, the guys who directed the last two movies, they will not be directing this, but they will be sticking around in a producerial capacity. And taking the directorial reins on Scream 7 will be Christopher Landon. This is good news, Ben.
Very good news. Yeah, this is Christopher Landon of Happy Death Day, Happy Death Day to You, and Freaky, and We Have a Ghost. He is on a real run at the moment, and he is so great at doing fun, funny, gory slasher movies. You know, he's got a real track record for doing teen-focused slashers that have a sense of edge to them and a sense of fun to them. And yeah, I'm kind of sad that the Radio Silence guys are moving on. They have a Universal monster movie of some description that they are working on. All of that is kind of tightly under wraps, which makes me think it might be The Mummy. That was a stupid joke. And
we have a moratorium on stupid jokes this week, Ben. Come on.
Okay. I retract my stupid mummy joke. So yeah, the Radio Silence guys are working on a Universal monster movie, and if anyone's going to step into the void that creates, Christopher Landon is an incredible choice. I'm very happy for him. If you've not seen Freaky, if you've not seen both of the Happy Death Day movies, then absolutely go out and do that. And my hope is that if he can continue this streak, and if he does Scream 7 and Scream 7 does really well, then maybe we finally get Happy Death Day 3, which he has been wanting to do for years now, and I've been wanting to watch for years now. So would be like super convenient if everybody could work that out. Maybe that's part of the AMTPT talks. Plus an extra clause. We need Christopher Landon's Happy Death Day 3, please.
That should have been clause number one, in fairness. That should have been demand number one. Never mind AI, never mind fair pay, residuals and fair pensions and healthcare and all the stuff and people being able to eat and pay for things and own their own homes and getting a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. All of that stuff should have come secondary to Christopher Landon being able to direct Happy Death Day 3.
I support that argument.
Amtapa would cave immediately if that had been one of the demands. I'm very excited about this. He is absolutely a horror geek. We've both interviewed him over the years. He is a very, very knowledgeable and talented guy. And he knows the slasher movies as well. So he put a lot of thought into the kills. And Freaky in particular, there's some amazing all-timer kills. And I'm looking very much forward to Scream 7. Now, of course, there's a lot of speculation already about Scream 7. Will Neve Campbell return? And I'm of the opinion that she shouldn't, that the story is now beginning to move on. I learned yesterday that Richard Newby of Hollywood Reporter, maybe I knew this, but it seemed to be new information to me. Apparently, Wes Craven had stipulated that Sydney should never die in a Scream movie, that she should get a happy ending. So let alone means don't bring her back, right?
Yeah, and I just think as well, they've done a really great job in Scream 5 and 6 of properly setting up a new generation of characters in Tara and Sam. That's Jenna Ortega's character and Melissa Barrera's character, the sisters, and this very specific dynamic they have, and especially where they are both at the end of Scream 6. What has gone down and the things that are uniting them in that moment at the end of that film. is really intriguing, and I want them to double down on that. I think the big thing will be making sure that they can get General Ortega, who is a massive, massive star now, post Wednesday, and has Wednesday season 2 coming up as well. So, I mean, I think really all their efforts theoretically going to go into getting General Ortega back. And as legendary as Neve Campbell is, I don't think they need her in this one, and she didn't get the offer that she deserved on the last one, and I just think they can let that character rest, have her time in the sun, living a lovely time with McDreamy somewhere off screen, you know? Let them have a nice life.
Let them have the win. Leave them alone, Ghostface. Also, this is an extension of something I was saying today on Twitter, but honestly, if you were considering being a Ghostface, wouldn't you decide not to, given the history of Ghostfacing? Wouldn't you just look at it and go, this isn't going to end well for me. I'm not going to be the one to buck the trend. I'm not going to be the one to succeed. Ghostfacing does not end well, so I'm not going to do it.
It does seem like they have a low life expectancy, Ghostfaces, and there's been plenty at this point.
And they all end badly. So I'm not so sure that I would have the confidence in myself. Like, what is it about me that sets me apart from all the other ghost faces? Why will I succeed where they failed? I just don't think it's going to work. Anyway, that is exciting, exciting news. What else has been happening? Jimbo, anything else going on?
Well, I have to say that after the horror show that was Secret Invasion, I was feeling a bit stung by the MCU, but I'm back on board. I was back on board seconds after we completed our final spoiler special for Secret Invasion, because as we were recording it, like the clouds parting and sun streaming through kind of stormy skies, we got the trailer for Loki season 2. And it's glorious, and it's delightful, and there's so much to unpack, and there's a lot going on, and Mobius is as brilliant as ever. I genuinely don't know what the season 2 is about. There are many, many conspiracies about, you know, how Jonathan Majors is going to fit into this, or whether he's going to fit into this, or in what way, quite whether they're in the divine timeline or not. There's so much in this trailer to speculate about that I'm already excited for not just watching it, but our weekly breakdowns of the show, because this is a show like WandaVision that lent itself so much to that kind of weekly chat and the kind of water cooler discussion, because there's so many threads and theories and conundrums at its center. And I'm counting down the missed minutes until it arrives.
And even though, you know, we don't know vast amounts about the plot of this one, it seems to be another mystery to an extent, where Loki is basically glitching in the same way that Miles Morales seemed to be in Across the Spider-Verse. I think that's a coincidence more than any kind of grand multiversal Marvel link between them. But yeah, Loki is glitching for some reason, and obviously the timeline is an absolute mess, and they're having to kind of figure that out and work out who the person is who becomes He Who Remains. They're going to theoretically be digging into some kind of Kang backstory. All of that is kind of a big unknown at the moment. But what you see straight away in this trailer, and that I think we've really been lacking in Secret Invasion, is a sense of visual flair and fun. And the first season in particular of Loki really dialed into his identity as the god of mischief, not just in the characterization, but in the show itself. The show had kind of a colorful, fluid, zigzagging kind of feel to it, that you didn't quite know what sort of imagery you were going to see next. It had a really kind of exciting visual identity. And you feel that coming through in this trailer, which is exciting, with kind of Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead coming back or entering into this as the kind of lead directors, having worked on Moon Knight. They have a really distinctive sense of a visual identity and great at producing kind of psychedelic, trippy visuals. So, yeah, really excited to see what they do with this as well.
Are they directing all 6 episodes of this one? I think they are. I think they're the only directors on this one. Which is interesting. Secret Invasion, let's just hope it was an aberration, and this is going to be a return to the quality that we can expect. It looks great. It was so funny that the trailer dropped while we were discussing Secret Invasion in our final spoiler special, and it was me.
I think it was Feige. He was like, "We've lost Hewitt. We've lost Hewitt. Quick, launch the trailer. Launch the trailer. Reel him back in. Bring him back to the fold. Come on.
Get him back in. Shiny stuff over this way, Chris. Forget this. Forget the shit show over here.
Girl.
Yes, very much that. Very much that.
By Kevin, or by Feige, you mean the Kevin, right?
Yes. Kevin dropped the trailer, and it looks so fun and so interesting, and there's so much going on, and there's lots of speculation. Obviously, Jonathan Majors is going to be in it as another Kang variant, and what's going to happen given his off-screen situation at the moment, and are they going to recast depending on how his trial comes out? And there's lots of speculation that Cuckoo and Batharoz, Ravonna Renslayer might be lined up to take over from Kang, to become a Kang of some kind, and then that will, you know, that will free things up moving forward. But yeah, we're getting lots of little interesting little hints and tidbits and pointers as to where this goes. Ki-Hi Kwan looks really, really funny as a character called Obi. There's a lovely exchange with him and Mobius about this thing that Loki is doing called time slipping, which of course bears a fair similarity to what Miles Morales goes through at certain points of the Spider-Verse movies. You get little glimpses of various characters. Sophia DiMartino as Sylvie. You got Wumi Misaku as B-15 coming back, but in very, very different guises. What has happened? Loki, Mobius had no memory of Loki at the end of the last season. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how does Loki persuade Mobius that he is a friend, not a foe? There's some really interesting stuff at the end about Loki kind of reclaiming his God of Mischief powers and owning that again. It all looks really, really good. I really, really hope that this one delivers, because Secret Invasion was a low point, and hopefully we can get back again. That would be nice.
It would.
There was some sad news this week. Paul Rubens, aka PB Herman, passed away at the age of 70 after a battle with cancer over the last few years. Twitter was united in praising him and his career. Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Tim Burton's very first film, is certainly one to seek out. And he worked a lot with Tim Burton through the years. He was the Penguin's dad in Batman Returns, of course. He's very funny in Mystery Men as Spleen. That's a fun film if you want to check it out. But he was recently, I think, doing a lot of cameos and stuff, and he's very, very funny in an episode of 30 Rock where he plays this demented, utterly demented character. Twitter was filled this week with great clips from his career. I haven't seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure in a long, long time, but hopefully I'll go back and get a chance to check it out. Paul Rubens, who was just 70 years old. All right. Time to segue seamlessly into Shameless Plug territory. Jimbo, before we talk about the new issue of Empire Magazine, which is on sale now, and all good, evil, and virtual newsagents, should we talk about some upcoming live shows?
I thought you were about to say what's coming up on the Pilot TV podcast.
Oh God, I would never say that. I would never normally go into
I'll
those.
I'll spare you the fact that Tiffany Haddish, I would say, joins us this week. She doesn't, because there's a strike on. She joined us a while back. We're playing it this week. So, you know. But yes, live events. We have a few, don't we? On the 19th of August, the Pilot 250th live show is at King's Place. That's very, very exciting.
Now, we should specify, this is not your 250th live show. This is the 250th
episode.
We've
done a lot of low-key live shows that you don't know about. No, it is the 250th episode. We are doing it live, kingsplace.co.uk/pilot250. Please do come along and see us. There will be cake, genuinely, because we are having a great Pilot TV bake-off. And that is actually a thing that's happening. I don't understand why, but it is happening. So do come along to that. But also, Empire is coming to King's Place as well in September, isn't it, Chris?
Twice, as a matter of fact. We're coming twice. So September 9th, tickets are still on sale for our London Podcast Festival show, which is going to be a lot of fun. September 9th, Saturday, September 9th. And then 5 days later, we're going to be doing a one-off, a mashup with Drunk Women Solving Crimes, a very fun podcast in which three women who are drunk solve crimes, which has just been picked up for adaptation into a TV show. Now, no one's picking this fucking thing up for adaptation into a TV show. So we are in fonted company for sure. And we're going to be doing Drunk Women Empire mashup. How it's going to work, I have no idea. It's going to be me, James, and Helen. None
drunk
of them
Empire
drink.
Solving films, except without alcohol.
Yeah, we don't drink. Yeah. We don't drink. So it's going to be me ripped to the tits on Coke Zero and Kit Kats. we haven't figured out the details of that, how it's going to work, but tickets are on sale for both of those shows, and in fact, Pilot's 250th show. Those are all available on kingsplace.co.uk. While we're plugging, should we plug the magazine?
Yes.
Let's. Ben. Tell us what is in the new issue of Empire magazine.
Talos. Tell us what's in the new magazine. Oh, God. Oh. I'm having secret invasion flashbacks.
Every actor who appears in the pages of Empire magazine for this issue during the strike is actually Talos in disguise. No, this is our new issue with Napoleon on the cover. Ridley Scott's Napoleon. You've got Joaquin Phoenix in a big old hat. And we have an incredible big feature by Alex Godfrey on that movie, on Ridley Scott's return to the historical epic. That's always a very exciting thing when he's back in vaguely Gladiator, Kingdom of Heaven, Last Duel mode, except this is going to be kind of a mashup of all of those by the sounds of things. It's a big sword swinging battles and blood and bodies historical epic, as you'd expect, but also it's like a deep dive into a deeply fucked up relationship between Napoleon Bonaparte and his wife Josephine, played by Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby. And yeah, Alex spoke to Ridley Scott and Phoenix and Kirby at length about this wild movie that they've made together. Tons of exclusive images. We also have a big old feature on Poor Things, the new Yorgos Lanthimos movie with Emma Stone and Willem Dafoe. We spoke to all of those guys about this wild new film that they've cooked up. You know, a Yorgos Lanthimos movie is always going to be something unexpected. This is his first film post The Favourite. That is an incredible read. We have a big old interview with Emma Corrin and an incredible shoot with them too, talking about A Murder at the End of the World, their new show, and their roles in My Policeman and The Crown and Lady Chatterley's Lover and what they're going to be doing moving forward. With, yeah, really, really incredible imagery on that one, courtesy of the art desk at Empire.
I was allowed to speak to Denzel Washington and Antoine Fuqua about The Equalizer 3 and their long working relationship, including a couple of lovely stories about Training Day. And that was a ton of fun. For anyone who listens to this podcast, you will know that I hold Equalizer films in very high regard. And I got to talk to Denzel and Antoine about that. And the only disappointment in it for me was that I only got to do it once. The Equalizer 3, of course, coming out very, very soon. Oh, yeah. Very exciting.
Yeah, that is a great piece. And we have Celine Song on Past Lives. We have a bunch of people paying tribute to Bruce Lee for the 50th anniversary of Enter the Dragon. So we've got Chad Stahelski, Gareth Evans, Shannon Lee, who's Bruce Lee's daughter and an actor. She's part of that. Scott Adkins, Cynthia Rothrock, all paying tribute to him and his legacy and Enter the Dragon in particular. We have a crazy look back at Caligula, which is about to receive some kind of new cut. This bonkers historical, basically erotic movie that kind of became...
It's porn, man.
It's porn. It's porn.
It wasn't porn, and then it became porn. Basically turned it into a porno. Yeah.
Is the new version still going to be porn? Let's find out. We also have... this is our first issue with a new look. We've had the decorators in. So when you get your new issue of Empire, it's all spiffy and nice and fresh looking. So yeah, Chris's section is no longer review. It is now final cuts. With tons of goodness.
I mean, is it though? I'm still very much thinking of it as review, but...
It's green now, Chris. It's green. And you have James Gunn reflecting on the journey of Rocket Raccoon. You talk to the directors of Dungeons & Dragons. You talk to Lee Cronin about Evil Dead Rise. The front section of the magazine now is no longer Take 20. That is First Word. And we have a big report from the strikes. We had people out on the picket lines talking to actors and writers
about the strikes and where they're at and what is happening in those negotiations or lack of negotiations until the upcoming AMPT talks. Plus, we talked to Zendaya, Mike Faist, and Josh O'Connor about challengers. Chris, you spoke to David Gordon Green about The Exorcist Believer. There's a bonkers trailer talk on the Wonka trailer, which... I kid you not, was like a 40-minute conversation in the office that was wildly off the rails from the first 30 seconds. It's, yeah, packed full of goodness.
And also in my section, we have a ranking. This month's ranking is the Pink Panther franchise, which might also be an answer to the question of, is there a franchise that has a 5-star, a 4-star, a 3-star, a 2-star, and a 1-star? But I'll be honest, folks, after watching all of them again, I'm not sure there's a 5-star in there. I'm not entirely sure there's a 4. Anywho, let's have a guest. So this week sees the release of Meg 2, The Trench, or Meg 2, The Trench, is like Step Up to the Streets, in which Meg steps up to the streets, in which Meg, the Megalodons return and ruin Jason Statham's day. This is a sequel, of course, to the original The Meg from, I think, was it 2018, 2017, something like that? It's been a few years now since we saw Jason Statham as Jonas Taylor punch the hell out of giant sharks. But they're back. And to make things really interesting, this is the big budget Hollywood movie debut of one of our favorite filmmakers, Ben Wheatley. And we showed the film last night as part of the Empire VIP Club. And let's keep the shameless plugs going. You can subscribe to that by going to empireonline.com/VIP to have a chance of attending incredible events like this. And afterwards, I sat down with Ben in front of the audience and had a lovely Q&A with him. Now, I had literally just seen the film, so thank God I liked it. Otherwise, this could have been a very, very, very awkward Q&A indeed. As it is, it's a lot of fun. Here's Ben Wheatley.
Please welcome the director of Meg 2 of the Trench, Ben Wheatley. You said before in your introduction that you had the time of your life making this, and yeah. I think it's very evident on screen. Tell us more. Tell us how you locked into this movie.
Well, Amy Jump and I were kind of working on Tomb Raider, and that was pottering along. And we were set to shoot, and then COVID happened. We were like, oh shit, and everything closed down, and that was it. It was kind of crashed and burned at that point. And then I started making In the Earth, and while I was making In the Earth in an abandoned hotel somewhere where everyone was bubbling together so that you couldn't catch the dreaded COVID, I got an email which had the Meg 2 script on it. And I went, what? And I thought, you know, I've always tried to make stuff that's 90 degrees from the last thing I made.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get more extreme whiplash from In the Earth, like the 1-2 hit of Rebecca In the Earth, Meg 2. Yeah. So that really appealed to me. And it was just bonkers. And I was thinking, well, you know, I've always wanted to work with Statham. I love giant monster movies.
Yeah.
And the script, I really enjoyed the script because it was basically like totally, the characters are so straight ahead and optimistic against all the odds, and they just want to power through, and there's no cynicism in them.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to make something that was like that. That just, it wasn't sarcastic about itself. It just was, you know, you as a filmmaker, you're going into it going, I love these kinds of movies and I want to make this fucking film, and I'm not, you know, you're with it. As a filmmaker going, I want to make sure that it's not really winking to the audience as silly as it can be. Mm-hmm. It believes in it.
Yeah.
100%.
Well, who was that email from, by the way? The one with the...
Well, it would have been through my agent. And,
okay.
But then it's talking to Belle Avery and Lorenzo, who are the producers of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a load of calls that I had to make and backwards and forwards and meeting up with them and pitching them stuff. But I think I just said I loved it and loved action. And it all come from Free Fire, really.
Yeah.
So they'd seen Free Fire and they went, oh, right. That's someone who enjoys genre.
Yeah.
And wants to make something that if you had a bit more money, you could get out of the room the Free Fire was set in and maraud about a bit, you know.
So you kind of went up a budget level with Rebecca, and then you went back again with In the Earth.
Yeah.
And then this obviously blows. I guess this is combined more than everything you'd worked on previously?
Times
by a multitude.
By about five, yeah.
What's it like going into that world? I mean, how do you adjust very quickly to that level?
I think I've always thought that budgets were like, you know, if it's more than you want to risk in a card game, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't matter, you know, if it's, you know, £10,000, hey, I play big card games. No, £50. But, you know, if it's 10 grand or a million, you know, half a million or a million, it's beyond thinking about. It's more than a house and more than all these things. So when it gets up to the really big stuff like this, it becomes quite abstract. Mm. But what it allows you to do is just opens up a load of possibilities, you know. And I found with this, it was like I kind of thought about it like it's like Spotify. When you first get Spotify and you're just limited by your own imagination of what you can listen to, and it was the same with this. You're like, this with this money you could do anything.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? And that's the pressure of it.
So when you come on board, when the script arrives, do you and Amy, do you work in the script? What sort of, did you overhaul the script or were you happy with it as it was?
It's more like you kind of, you're talking to the producers and you're, what I wanted to do was get a united front. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to have a situation where I'm arguing with people on the floor or while we're shooting it or in the edit suite. I don't want that. I want to be as clear as I can about everything. So there was a lot of like work done on storyboards, and it was like, that was where I changed the script. So the action is not in the script pretty much.
Okay.
The action all comes from drawings and kind of, I think there's even a line in the script, which is the most incredible action sequence ever. You know, it's just like, thanks, guys. Yeah, okay. But it is great because it allows you, it's a free hand to kind of develop stuff. So so I wouldn't necessarily, you know, as a big group of us, we're all looking at the script and kind of prodding it and poking it, and there's different, people want different things out of it. But then, you know, to the side, I'm kind of merrily rewriting the action with pictures.
Mm-hmm. What was really fascinating? There's a lot of stuff towards the end. There's a lot of stuff where there's CG involved, of course, but there's shots of the Staithe on a jet ski that looked like you had the Staithe on a jet ski, and you were strapping the camera to him.
He absolutely insisted, and he came back in the edit and he took out anything that was on a gimbal, you know, except for the really extreme shit like going up on that wave. And even he couldn't do that. But all the rest of it was him. For real, you know. And so they went, the second unit went out with him and he just went blasting around on that jet ski for hours. That was it. And then and going really fast and just giving everyone a heart attack. Just like, just going, oh my God, if he comes, it's like right at the beginning of the shoot in Thailand, if he comes off this, he's just going to turn to paste. Oh, but then the Wu Jin was the same, you know. I was like, oh, we're doing this stuff with helicopters. And he's going, oh yeah, great. And they get the rushes back and he's hanging off the side of it. He's just like, what? No, that wasn't asked for.
yeah. Like I've got severe Tom Cruise vibes off that bit.
Yeah, totally.
As well. So that's what you want. You want that sense of peril. You want the sense of the actors.
There was no plot reason for that. It's like when you ride a helicopter, you go, what I need to do is stand on the skid as we're going. It's not dangerous enough for me.
You said you were wanted to work with Statham for a while.
Mm.
What was the experience like? And how long have you known him for a while?
No, I mean, just on the job. So
okay.
It's kind of, yeah, I mean, he's obviously a massive action star and knows what he's doing, you know, has been in, experienced lots of different movies and understands his own physical sense of himself and what the audience wants. So there is a conversation back and forth about, you know, how, you know, what a hero is to his audience. Mm. And then you kind of work it out like that. But then Wu Jin's exactly the same. So he's like, you know, in the Chinese style of filmmaking is you go on set and throw the script in the bin and make it all up from scratch to make for the betterment of the movie, you know. So there's a lot of that kind of intense kind of talking backwards and forwards and working it out as we're shooting it. But luckily, I think the spine of the script was strong and the storyboards were strong. So it kind of kept that kind of energy in check.
It's interesting how you maintain the balance. It's an ensemble movie. Obviously, it's a Statham movie, but it's an ensemble film as well.
Yeah.
Everyone gets something to do. There's real balance between the characters at the end.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, that was worked on a lot. And it was like the idea, obviously, because Wu Jin is an action star in his own right, and has done movies that are like Statham movies in China. So we couldn't just have another Statham turn up. So that kind of had to be balanced, so that he was very keen to play against type and not do any kung fu and do and he was playing like a scientist, basically.
It was interesting. I noticed a couple of Ben Wheatley Repertory Company players. Robin Hill,
yep,
is in this. Sienna Guillory, you've worked with before, yep, as yep. well. Anyone else that you snuck in? Richard Glover, where was he?
He's riding a helicopter.
Okay.
Tony Wei was in it, but didn't make the cut.
Oh, no.
And guess what happened to him?
He got eaten.
Yeah, he died.
There you go. And you wanted to get those people in.
Yeah, definitely. It was great to see Rob in it.
Yeah.
You know, and we had a good laugh on the days he was in. So, and he doesn't get killed and he gets to mug Statham off. So it was, so he might get to return, you know.
In Meg 3.
Yeah, in Meg 3. Yeah, the pirate story.
Yeah. Entirely from his point of view.
Yeah, exactly. From his point of view. Dumping shit off the side of boats.
as someone who loves genre like you do, you know, when you're working with sharks, there's a pretty big shadow. Jaws 3. Everyone's thinking about
it. I thought you were going to go Jaws 2. That's my favorite.
That's the one you mentioned. You actually, yeah. It gets name checked.
Jeno Schwartz.
Hang on, I've got to pick you up on that one. Jaws 2 is your favorite?
Well, I'm kidding.
Rewind.
You're talking about Jaws 3. It's Jaws 2 is obviously the better film than Jaws 3.
It is, yeah.
But the
Jaws 4 is the one.
Spielberg is, you know, the Jaws itself is my favorite film, I think. And I watch it every year, and I've been watching it since I was a kid. So, and it's not just the best shark film. Obviously, it's one of the best films ever.
Yeah.
And bears rewatching a lot. And it's even more irritating because he did it when he was like 26. So it's like almost a perfect film for me, I think.
Did you take inspiration from it, or do you run the in the shark opposite film? Direction? Yeah. Well, because there's a moment in here where you're almost recreating Quint's death.
Yes.
I don't want to get too much into spoilers.
That's absolutely,
it.
Yeah. That's on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also a reference to Roland Emmerich's Godzilla.
As all good films must be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk about that? That sort of the shadow of Spielberg, trying to avoid it, trying to do your own
thing? I don't think you can avoid it. You just have to embrace it because it's so much in culture. There's no kind of getting sniffy and going, oh no, I don't, ooh. You know, I didn't watch that. You know, it's, yeah. And it's also that kind of, that film bridges the horror and entertainment at the same time as well. Probably one of the first films to do that it's, and it's the first ever blockbuster. I mean, yeah. there's so much about Jaws that's super important. And then it's like a deeply weird film in its own sense.
Yeah, it slows down for the last 45 minutes and has a bunch of guys on a boat just nattering.
Yeah, what happens
nattering.
To Brody's wife?
Yeah.
See ya. Like, I'm not in the film anymore. And the mayor. I was important, wasn't I? No. Which is still all great, you know. And that, and it's that kind of, and it's a bridge for Spielberg from, I suppose he does it a bit more in Close Encounters, but there's almost that kind of American socio-realist stuff in there as well. Yeah. And like those performances are slightly improv-y and kind of, yeah, it's just a...
But he blocks the action as well.
Yeah, well, there's Crazy Oneers, which are kind of completely artificial, but brilliant. And then crazy, like real life family stuff, dynamic stuff going on in there, incredibly, you know, nuanced performance. It's great.
That film famously had a troubleshoot. Sort of Jaws 2, by the way. If you've ever... read about, you know, if you've never read about the making of Jaws 2, it was as nightmarish as Jaws. They replaced the director, the original director. He was the guy who directed Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and he did 6 weeks and then they got rid of him and it was just hell from that point on. But that, of course, was famously, you know, one of the don't shoot on water. Do not shoot on water. Do not shoot in boats. Did you learn from that?
No. Just to say, like, I have a theory for Jaws 2.
Okay.
Friday the 13th.
Right.
Is the same year.
It is?
It's the same film. It's like horny teenagers.
Right.
Getting murdered. And like the more horny they are, the more likely they get killed, which is exactly what happens in Jaws 2.
So are you saying...
Except for they're just on the lake rather than in tents.
Are you saying that the shark in Jaws 2 is Jason?
Yes.
So it's the son of the shark from the original movie.
Maybe.
Should we interrogate this theory?
Well, I mean, I think the thing is, you've got to believe that it's a family of sharks in the Jaws.
Well, you have
movies,
to.
Yeah. Right up to the one that tries to kill Michael Caine.
Yeah.
It's pierced by his boat, which is incredible.
Comes after Lorraine Gary. It's bumped. It's knocked off one of the Brody kids, and now it comes after Lorraine Gary.
We did watch that one a lot, and especially for roaring sharks, because that does a lot of roaring, that
shark. It does.
And I was told in uncertain terms that sharks don't have vocal cords.
Come on.
I know, it's ridiculous, but they don't.
You got some license to play with, surely, some creative license here.
But I think in Jaws 4, it comes out and goes back in, doesn't it? It's taunting them with it.
Stay away from that for this one. Were you realistic with the sharks? Did you have megalodon experts on set to go?
A team of them over my shoulder all the time. Yeah, we were really serious about getting it exactly right.
It's a documentary style movie.
It's important. I don't want one marine biologist to be put out of, you know, of the movie. What the fuck,
dear Mr. Wheatley?
Why, oh, why, oh, why?
Is the plan then to make more movies like this?
I mean, well, what I'm doing next is 6 hours for Channel 4 TV series. Mm-hmm. So horror-based thing. So, yeah, I'm going in the same way that I did in The Earth after Rebecca. I'll do something that's back to kind of kill listy, sightseersy world. And then once I've got that out of my system, then I'll be looking to do another larger film. But yeah, nothing, you know, the world is completely unknitted thanks to the various strikes. Yeah. So there's nothing, who knows what the situation will be like in the new year. But yeah, I mean, there's skills learned on this, which are patently not transferable to anything else, but doing something massive. So, yeah.
What was the skill that you took away from this that you didn't have before?
Not running into the corner and crying and weeping because it's also pressurized, like holding the line, you know. And I think that with multiple kind of fast and difficult decisions, having the energy to do it. I've always worried about that as I've made, you know, over the 10 years I've been making films. Most of them are not longer than 7 weeks or 8 weeks. And you're exhausted after that. And then something like this, we see 16, and by the time you've done the post, it's like 2 years.
Yeah.
I always wondered what that was going to be like, and thankfully it was fine, you know, and you adjust. But you do find that over the run of it, you are a different person by the end, which you aren't when you make the short films. You're like that person, definitely, as you make it. But by the time something like this, I mean, I was on this for 3 years. So, and you're forced to make decisions because of post that you don't see for a year. I mean, on this, we didn't see the sharks until the last 2 weeks of post.
Jeez.
So it all looked like PlayStation 2.
And then you're just fingers crossed. I hope.
Yeah. Well, you know that they're the best in the world, the people doing it. So you trust them, but you can't help being human and going, oh God, please. But then the thing was, we did test this really early. You know, we tested it with none of the effects in and got good reaction. So we knew we were all right. And it was only going to get better once the actual sharks were in it. And it turned out, yeah, that's great. But it's like making a movie with the star isn't there for most of the time of it.
Jesus. What was that like, that you know, yielding to that sort of test screening process? And how often have you done it in your career? I'm guessing Down Terrace is not something you test.
No, didn't test that. We did test Free Fire.
Right.
But not in a way that was relevant because we never acted on any of it. I mean, I remember that we did the first test of it and they went, yeah, it doesn't play well with over 50-year-old women. And I'm like, you didn't need to fucking test it to know that. You know, it's like that was evident. And then I read the cards, which I should never have done. And one of them was like, I faint at the sight of blood. This film was terrible for me. Fucking Free Fire. Yeah, brilliant. But so that, you know, but this one, yes, we tested Rebecca and kind of did audience reactions in a more meaningful way.
Yeah.
But on this, we tested a lot, like 6-7 times, I think. And there was videos of the audience in infrared and it was really useful. You know, you could really see what played. And if there was a discussion and someone was going, this is really good, blah, blah, blah. And then you test it and it doesn't get a reaction, go, that that didn't work, did it? And everyone will admit that at that point.
Okay.
But equally, you can kind of risk stuff and go, I think this moment is going to play really well. And they'll all go, will it? And then you see it and you can play the infrared footage back and go, look, that's the reaction. They're enjoying it or they're not enjoying it. So it's very binary like that.
There's an amazing shot where we see inside Meg's mouth as it's chomping on a whole bunch of people.
Yes.
Pure Ben Wheatley. Where did that come from?
Yeah, yeah. That was from I sat down and drew up a load of gags for the shark. Mm. That was one. The pedalo was the other one. And I can't remember. There was another one. Oh, there was one with, that was, which didn't get in, which was Tony Way, who was on a yacht going like this with a drink, and then the shark hit him. And then there was one where the shark jumped up onto the cabana thing and rolled around on the thing eating people and then ate the DJ. That didn't make it in. That's my one regret.
Oh, sad to end on a note of regret, but there we are. Thanks so much for coming, guys. Thanks for your questions. Thank you. Thanks, of course, Ben Wheatley, everybody.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Okay, so that was Ben Wheatley talking about Meg 2, The Trench. Ben, you saw it last night as well. What did you think?
I had fun with Meg 2, The Trench. It's not the Meg 2, it is just Meg 2. Drop the, it's cleaner. And, you know, you get to watch this big, crazy, stupid, giant shark movie and then have the thrill of the end credits popping up and saying, a Ben Wheatley film. That's just a unique situation to be in. So yeah, this is Ben Wheatley picking up from John Turteltaub. Return of Jason Statham as, you mentioned, Jonas Taylor, who basically in this one is Deckard Shaw, but like a little bit nicer. He's in kind of action spy mode. He is hiding away in ocean liners and spying and getting caught out by parrots. That is an actual thing that happens in this movie. And he is soon roped into a mission. They have to go down into the trench from whence the Meg once came. They have new technology that now allows them to go beneath the thermal layer that has been trapping all of the Meggy evil down in the deep. And once that breach is ruptured, all kinds of beasties come out. Jason Statham and a bunch of other marine biologist people, I guess, are all trapped at the bottom of the ocean, trying to survive, and there are Megs making their way out of the thermo layer and into the regular old ocean. And what do you
the
know?
Regular layer.
Jason Statham has to get on a jet ski and sort it all out. That is the film. It is exactly what you'd expect from that. It is silly and a bit rubbish, but really fun, and I think Ben Wheatley has fun with it. What was really nice, Chris, in the interview that people have just heard and that I heard in front of the audience last night, is that he is not Ben Wheatleyifying this. There is not kitchen sink drama. There is not nightmare hallucinogenic sequences. You're not going to get those kind of that kind of Ben Wheatley-isms, but he wanted to make a big studio monster movie, and he has made that, and he's leaned in to all of the tropes, all of the trappings. This film for me feels a bit more in on the joke than the last one did. I feel like the marketing for the Meg was much jokier and winkier than the actual film was, and I think going into this one, Statham is in full on, every line he says is basically a quip or telling a small child that they're going to be okay, even though there are giant marauding sharks everywhere. It's playing on this kind of fun, knowing register. For me, there was still a bit much in the way of like talky stuff. You know, it kicks off in quite a fun way, but I struggled a bit when they get to the trench. They are in the trench for a while, and I thought the film slowed down at that point. And to necessitate them getting down to the trench, there is a fair amount of marine waffling that I kind of could have done without. But the final act of this is really fun. Megs everywhere, people screaming, Jason Statham on a jet ski, good times. Oh, yeah, I had fun with this. There's all sorts of beasties in it. It is not going to change the world, but if you are going to the cinema to see a fun Meg movie, having enjoyed The Meg, I'm pretty sure you're going to enjoy Meg 2, The Trench.
Yeah, I think I had a bit more fun with this than you did. I think that this is almost one of those evolutionary leaps that a franchise is capable of taking, where it really, really utterly embraces the ridiculous. Not to say that the first one didn't do that, but I felt that Ben Wheatley is better at nailing that sense of the ridiculous than John Turteltaub was on the first movie. And this feels to me like almost it's not quite the evolutionary step that Fast Five was from Fast and Furious and from the rest of those movies, but it's not far off. I had an absolute blast with this, and I was so relieved because I was doing a Q&A with Ben Wheatley immediately afterwards. And yeah, I'm a professional, obviously, and I would have been able to mask it. But if you talk to someone immediately after seeing a bad film, that can be a tough one to get past. I didn't like the first movie at all. I think the first movie is bad. And I was honestly expecting Ben Wheatley to be chewed up and spat out by the movie making machine here. And it's not just Hollywood, this is a Chinese co-production as well. And Wu Qing is basically the co-lead along with Jason Statham in this. And if there were dual pressures on Ben Wheatley, he handled it very, very adroitly. And I think there's lots of Ben Wheatley-isms in the movie. There's some great shots that I don't know whether I've left it in, but we talked about one POV shot in particular, which made me chuckle. There's a very, very dark sense of humor that shoots through this film, also. And the Stath is on great form. I like what they did with Cliff Curtis's character. I like what they did with Paige Kennedy's character, DJ, who gets a lot more to do this time around. It's just absolute nonsense and carnage, and it leans into that. And I had a really, really good, great time. You gave it 3. I had a ton of fun with this. I had such a fun time with it. And it made me laugh a lot with the absurdity of it all. But we gave it 3.
I'm really excited for the DVD release or the home ends release, because a lot of my DVD and Blu-ray shelves are grouped by director if I've got a lot of their body of work, and I cannot wait to put the Meg 2 the Trench next to In the Earth, next to, oh, there never was a Blu-ray release of Happy New Year, Colin Burstead, or Rebecca, sadly. But if they do, they're going to go right next to Meg 2 on my shelf.
Indeed. All right, 3 stars then for Meg 2, The Trench. Next up, we have a film that came out on Monday, which is now a new thing. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem. Jimbo, you've seen this one, haven't you?
I have indeed seen Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I can say exclusively here, it is by some degree the best Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film. However, that was not a particularly tricky bar to clear, I would say. So this one comes to us from Jeff Rowe, who co-directed the phenomenally good 5-star film, thank you, Ben Travis, yes, Mitchells versus the Machines. And this stars the sort of sewer-dwelling turtles, but in a slightly different way. So it kind of maintains that kind of... it seems reductive to compare it to Spider-Verse, but it has a very distinctive visual style. It's scrappy, it's sketched, it's a mix of 2D, 3D. It's very, very effective. It makes the film beautiful to look at. But also the turtles here have real character. And I think part of that is because of the casting. They cast actual teenagers as the turtles, which gives them a sense of real adolescence, which I actually think you always got from the comics, I think has often been lost from this franchise. And it's a really fun story there. You know, they are, as we know, they've been subjected to mutant creating ooze in the sewers as little turtlets, and they grow into kung fu loving adult, well, adolescent turtles. In this, they decide to try and force acceptance from society by taking down the criminal that is terrorizing the city in the form of Ice Cube's Superfly, a fly mutant surrounded by a cadre of other mutants who are all, frankly, singularly hilarious and voiced by massive, massive stars. It's a lot of fun, and I will say this has maybe 5 or 6 properly genius gold-clad standout jokes, including one involving the Hollywood Chrises, which are genuinely brilliant. And actually, I think in terms of salvaging Turtles, which are great comics, but have never really, I think, worked on the big screen before. I think this is by far and away, as I say, the best attempt to do it. And it really succeeds in capturing what makes the Turtles fun to hang around with. They all have distinctive, not just visual identities, but personalities. They do feel sort of a piece, but also distinct. And as I say, some of the gags in it are brilliant. I think where I fell from this, I think a lot of people like this more than I did, not just because it's animation, but I think for me, where the plot goes in the third act for me, it lost my interest a little bit. Like my joy for this faded into the third act. Though I will concede at this point, I do think I may be in the minority here. Most people I spoke to when I came out loved it. But I felt like by the end it had dragged a little bit. But look, it's joyful, it's fun, it looks beautiful. There's a lot to enjoy here. Plus it has Jackie Chan as a rat. And, you know, that's a recommendation.
And an incredible hip hop soundtrack. They don't only have Ice Cube voicing Superfly, but they have, you know, a real stacked roster of like 90s hip hop songs. There's a lot of Tribe Called Quest in there. It's just feel good energy from front to back. The look of this, it can't be understated how incredible it looks. As James said, it's got this kind of sketchy hand-drawn pencil textures, scribbles across the screen to get this kind of youthful energy across. And the turtles themselves weirdly almost feel like this kind of claymation texture, or like it changes from shot to shot how the turtles look and feel based on the environment they're in, which is really, really smart. Yeah, this is a really good time. My one qualm would be I liked how they, you know, made the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles actual teenagers, as you said, and they have a really fun conversational style together. I think they actually did get the four young actors in the room together to record so that they captured that energy of them all kind of pinging off each other. I wish there was a little bit more distinction between those individual turtle personalities, because I know that's a really distinct thing from other variations of these characters. And as fun as they all are together, I didn't always get a sense of like, oh, that is absolutely a Donatello thing to say, or that's absolutely a Michelangelo thing to say. But you're kind of just having too much fun hearing them all like take the piss out of each other and rile each other on to worry about that in the moment. And yeah, it looks stunning, tons of fun. Jeff Rowe, I think, did a great job coming off Mitchell's vs. the Machines and coming into this. Very exciting.
I don't think Raphael enjoyed the film though. Big size.
I don't understand that. I saw this weeks ago. I feel very tired.
I feel at this point, were I to explain the joke, it would make it even worse. So I'm just going to leave it out there and say that was an excellent joke for those who understood it. And if you didn't, move along.
But surely, James, size matter not.
Oh, yes.
Judge me by my size, do you?
We do, yes.
Damn it. All right. I haven't seen this one yet. I'm very excited to do so. We gave it 4 stars in a cracking year, a halcyon year for animation on the big screen. 4 stars then for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, Turtle Power. Turtle Power.
Turtle Power.
Last but not least this week is Joyride Jimbo.
Yes, indeed. So this is directed by Crazy Rich Asians co-writer Adele Lim in her directorial debut. And frankly, what a debut it is. This is a film which wholeheartedly, to me at least, lives up to the title. So it is essentially a girls' road trip comedy film. It starts with two young girls in a playground in a place called, I think it's called like White Hill. It is the whitest neighborhood around, and they're the only two Chinese kids there. They instantly form a bond. It is Audrey, who will, when she grows up, be played by Ashley Park, and Lolo, who will, when she grows up, be played by Sherry Kohler. Sherry is this kind of like, not when she's a kid, but when she grows up, she's this kind of sex-positive artist. She's a bit bohemian. Audrey is more of a kind of button-down. She's a lawyer. She code-switches between her sort of white, mainly male colleagues, and she gets sent on a business trip to China, and Lolo tags along. And more to the point, they also bring a friend of theirs called Deadeye, played by Sabrina Wu, on this road trip as well. And when they get there, they meet up with Audrey's college friend Kat, played by the excellent Stephanie Su, aka Jobu Tapaki. And this essentially becomes a road trip around China as they all try to, well, partly so that Audrey can because she's adopted by white parents, so she can get in touch with her Chinese heritage, her Chinese identity. She's someone who feels too Chinese for America and too white for China. And it's a film about bonding. It's a film about cultural identity. Each one of them brings a very distinct kind of take on the Asian American experience. And all of that stuff is beautifully, beautifully subtly done. But it's really, really fucking funny all the way through, and really filthy funny as well. It's got sex, it's got drugs, it's got vajazzles, it's got so much going on. And there is genuinely, like, there's a laugh out loud gag in this film less than 2 minutes in, and it really sets the tone for this. Like, I am famously humorless, as you know, and I found this properly hysterical. I watched this with Helen. I was pissing myself all the way through it. I found it absolutely joyful. There's like a K-pop sequence in it, which is, I mean, let's just say it's an image that will stick with you for the rest of this year by the time you get to the end of that. I mean, genuinely, it's brilliant. All four of those leads are fantastic. And this is one of the best times I think it's possible to have in the cinema this year. I genuinely do. I had an absolute joyride, frankly, watching it. So there you go.
Wow.
It is
sold.
It's really good fun. The other thing is that it is surprisingly emotional. I have to say, I really laughed a lot early on. And for me, some of the laughter, it's a very, very broad comedy, and quite a lot of it, they're very talented and funny performers, but quite a lot of the gags, I'd say, in the middle section feel a bit more improvised at points. And the humor kind of dipped for me, but the emotional side really kicks in towards the end in a way that feels really earned and really satisfying. It goes to some, you know, surprisingly touching places. So there's a lot of laughs to be had, but it comes with some real substance to it as well. I think that's why, you know, the fun stuff feels as fun as it does, because it knows when and how to get serious, which I think is a really kind of smart balance. And yeah, as you said, the cast is great. I thought Sherry Kohler, I don't think I'd seen her in many things, and I thought she was just a complete whirlwind, as is Sabrina Wu, who plays Deadeye. They are really, really funny and have a completely different energy to everybody else, and they just complement the other women really, really smartly. So, yeah, this is a lot of fun. The comedy is very broad and, as James said, very rude. So don't take your parents. but take a load of mates, have a couple of drinks, have some Sherry Colas, and you'll have a really good time with this.
All right. That sounds exciting. We get this 4 stars then, I'm guessing.
Yes.
4 stars. What a week. What a week. What a week at the multiplex. Go and see films. Folks, go and see films is all I can say on that one. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we, but possibly not me, will be joined by, because I'm going to be in Northern Ireland and I don't know whether my sister's Wi-Fi can frankly hold up to the task. But we will be joined by actual actors. It doesn't mean the strike is over. The strike is on, but this is an interview that was recorded before the strike, and it is with the stars of the new Netflix spy actioner, Heart of Stone, Alia Bhatt, and Gal Gadot. Oh yes. Oh yes indeed, folks. And there may be also someone else as well. We shall see. We shall see. But anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye for my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Ben Travis.
Rise of Skywalker is a 4-star movie. Goodbye.
I said no stupid jokes, Ben.
Fuck off.
Wow. Poke the bear. Poke the bear.
You're going to unleash the Godzilla King of the Monsters rage.
The dark passenger has arrived. It's goodbye from James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris. I will concede Rise of Skywalker is better than Wonder Woman 1984.
That's true. I agree.
Oh, my God. All right. Let's not bring Molly's game into this, shall we? The Aaron Sorkin Cinematic Universe will be here all year. It's goodbye for me as well. I am off to rate my two colleagues of such lethal cunning along the same criteria. One of them is a 5-star. One of them is a 1-star. Which is which? Interesting. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.